Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, a new book of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan's correspondence reveals the politics of the past and how it has changed. Then, scandal and silence. Why some misdeeds become scandals and others don't, and how they affect our society. Times have changed in Washington, marked by polarized politics and unfriendly rancor. The old school decorum has ostensibly faded. Among the senators who most exemplified the possibility of bipartisanship and big ideas was Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the longshoreman turned scholar turned politician. A new book titled Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait in Letters of an American Visionary, features one of his most prolific aspects, his letter writing prowess. Through his letters, he shows a changing Congress and changing world. We have with us the author, a fellow and journalist, Stephen Weissman. Stephen Weissman is editorial director and public policy fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a former journalist at the New York Times and Time magazine. Welcome, Stephen Weissman.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Why don't we start with this kind of larger historical context of Senator Moynihan? The letters seem to paint this picture of a guy who was very bipartisan, who got along pretty much with everybody, worked with both sides. I mean, he's the guy who brought Ralph Nader in to Washington, defended him to the core, and yet worked for Richard Nixon. How do we explain this?
It's hard to explain, but one of the things we learn from these letters is from his diaries, these very early diaries in the 1950s, and these letters go from the 1950s all the way into the 21st century. Is that he came from a broken family. His father abandoned him, his family when Pat Moynihan was only 10, and he never saw him again. He had a feel for impoverished families that were broken, and that became his signature issue all through his career. But it led to something else, I believe, which is that he believed in the institution of government and the stability of government. His whole career was a search for stability, both in his family and in politics. And this led him to hope and support that presidents, even those with whom he disagreed and who were on from the other side of the aisle, should succeed. And that led him, as a lifelong Democrat, to work for Richard Nixon in the hope, which he later believed was somewhat naive, that Richard Nixon could find a new center for American politics. At a time of maximum instability, when there were riots in the cities, there were riots on campuses, there was poisonous racial and generational and cultural divisions, he wanted the presidency to succeed.
When we look at this man, and he, you said he then thought maybe he was a little bit naive, but he did seem to have some traction with Nixon.
Oh, he did. You know, one of the things that comes across in these letters is a Nixon that I think a lot of people, certainly your listeners, certainly myself, didn't recognize. But Nixon, in a way, was an intellectual. He's a soldier in the Cold War. He was anti-communist to the core in his early career, which was here in Southern California. Moynihan appealed to his intellectual interests. Mm-hmm. Moynihan could say to him, you know, what you're trying to do, Mr. President, is similar to what Benjamin Disraeli tried to do in the 19th century British politics, which is engage in social reforms, but as a conservative. And he tried to appeal to Nixon's almost, you might say, intellectual vanity. And Nixon went ahead and read biographies of Benjamin Disraeli and became fascinated
at the urging of Moynihan.
And their relationship, which comes out in these letters, is utterly fascinating. It's different from anything I understood existed before. And when Nixon was ousted and forced out after Watergate in the mid-1970s, Moynihan was ambassador to India, and he gives a wonderful address to the employees of the American Embassy, where he says, look, this man committed impeachable offenses. He had to go. But we who serve in government should remember that Nixon has now become the third president in a row ousted from office or violently taken from office. Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson was ousted by an uprising over the war. Nixon now was impeached. Moynihan said, this is something we should think about because we have to be concerned with the legitimacy of government and government institutions. And I think those words speak to us now in the year 2010 so powerfully.
One of the other things I think it captured was that even though there was strong line between liberals and conservatives or Democrats and Republicans, however that might be articulated, there was this ability to bridge during that time that doesn't seem to be quite so present anymore.
I think you're right. Moynihan sort of had a tribal view of politics. He was from the tribe of Irish Catholic Democrats in New York, grew up in Hell's Kitchen, where everything was going to be determined by whether you were from the Jewish tribe or the Irish tribe or the Italian tribe.
That's right. He wrote about ethnicity as a scholar.
It was his first subject, and he, when he collaborated with Nathan Glaser, the great Harvard sociologist, on Beyond the Melting Pot, which came out in the early 60s, which understood that ethnicity was the basis of American politics in the cities. And he also, by the way, later understood that it was the basis for national politics all around the world in the Balkans.
International wars.
So he understood that from a variety of perspectives. But there was another aspect of his tribal politics. It's a little different. He understood that politicians themselves were kind of part of a tribe. They understood that the person they were fighting with one day was going to have to be somebody that they'd have to collaborate with the next day. And when you're in a tribe in the Senate or in the House and you have to work with people and get the votes where you can, that reintroduces a sense of civility and even a sense of humor and perspective into politics that we've tended to forget must exist today, where everything is warfare and determined by, if I may say, the exaggerated, almost cartoon-like depictions that you hear too much on cable TV or wherever.
His time was a time when people could be more accommodating for the other side, I think. But it was also partly who he was. I wonder, are there Moynihans today?
I think not, but I like to think that even on both sides, there are those who believed first and foremost in looking at the facts. And Moynihan, one of his signature sayings is, everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. Of course, what we now have is people who look not only at opinions and facts, but they look at narratives. You know, they selectively look at facts and they put together a narrative. And that's where our politics have gone, sometimes not to the benefit of our political system. There's hardly anyone on the scene like Pat Moynihan today. You know, when he first ran for office in 1976, his opponent tried to belittle him by calling him Professor Moynihan in all their debates and in all his appearances. And Moynihan's response was, well, the mudslinging has begun. So he had a kind of ironic sense of humor, almost, you know, able to diffuse the bitterness of politics. That's also an awfully rare commodity.
I want to go back to Nixon for just a minute.
Sure.
Because one of the letters I thought was pretty remarkable when he said, you know, he had defended Nixon. And he asks, was I a fool or was I a whore or both?
Such a powerful letter. He wrote that as Watergate was sinking the Nixon presidency, and he was sent off to India to be ambassador, which was one of the more interesting, trying, and challenging periods of his life. I lived in India for 3.5 years, and I must say I have a personal love of the letters from India, because while he was engaging in these ethnic issues in India, he was also looking from thousands of miles away from the other side of the globe at this presidency. And he was writing to his best friend, Nathan Glaser, with whom he collaborated on the Beyond the Melting Pot book. And he used those words. Aren't they amazing? I mean, I really felt in doing this book, I knew Pat Moynihan, but I learned something about him as I took this journey through the decades of his career, which was also a journey through the second half of the 20th century, really, of American politics, which was that he was much more anguished, much more hurt, much more proud and self-aware and self-referential than could be understood with his many books and public utterances. You can see through these letters this evolution of his personal passions, but you can also see that the scars and the hurts, and he did feel in the Nixon years, as Nixon was running into the ground, that his own reputation was ruined. It's amazing how it comes across in his personal writings.
His life seems to exemplify several things. One is that American success story from start with
his
broken family,
yeah,
and then, you know, became a longshoreman and then became a scholar and then into politics. And so he really is kind of
very unusual.
A poster child of a success story from very humble roots. But there are a few other things that I kind of captured in this. One is it's both a story of how one person can make a difference and at the same time a story of how hard it is to make a difference.
Well, Pat Moynihan used to say, if you're not willing to put 20 or 30 years into something, trying to get something enacted, then you don't belong in politics. He worked patiently on issues over a long period of time. He started in the early 1960s writing to Lyndon Johnson about the plight of the African-American family, the Negro family, as he called it in his famous Moynihan report. But it wasn't until the late 1980s that he really brought about changes in the welfare system that he had started to try and bring about. And he spectacularly failed in the Nixon years when they tried to put through the Family Assistance Plan. His career is a testimony to, yes, as you say, kind of up from humble beginnings, but it is also is a testimony to persistence and patience. There's another example of that, which is some of the urban renewal projects, like in Pennsylvania Avenue, which again started in the early 1960s and ended up in the 1990s being completed. And if you've been to Washington today and you see Pennsylvania Avenue with the Willard Hotel and the Ronald Reagan Building all spiffed up and looking great, there's a little place on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's called Daniel Patrick Moynihan Place, just to signal his role in a project like that, which took 25, 30 years to bring to fruition.
Now, if we fast forward his work to the Clinton, he was immensely disappointed in Bill Clinton, it seemed, particularly with the health care bill.
They tangled on that, yes. They had a difference of priorities. Shortly after Clinton took office, Moynihan went on Meet the Press, which was hosted by Tim Russert, who had worked for Pat as a press secretary, and said, there's no health care crisis in this country, which was exactly the opposite of what the White House was saying. That was not a particularly good relationship. They tangled. He tangled with Hillary Clinton. In the end,
he endorsed her.
He endorsed her and really helped to anoint her. And on election night in 2000, the famous Bush v. Gore night, Bill Clinton turned to Pat Moynihan and said, without your endorsement, she wouldn't have won.
Let me remind our listeners that we're speaking with Stephen Wiseman, and the book is called Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait in Letters of an American Visionary. You know, I think this array of letters shows us the inner workings of government and
it really
the
does,
inner
yeah.
workings of relationships. And you go way back into, I think this was an RFK letter where he talks about J. Edgar Hoover was who it was.
Oh,
who
yes,
would send
yes.
these photographs.
Incriminating information about Martin Luther King, I think. And
the one memo was about J. Edgar Hoover sending regular reports about RFK's sex life just to show they were watching him.
Yeah.
Tells us a lot about how Washington works, I think.
You know, Pat Moynihan had a very bad relationship with the FBI and the CIA. In 1979, Pat Moynihan predicted that the Soviet Union would fall. That was a good more than a decade before it fell. An amazing example of his ability to prophesy things before they happen. Going back to the early 1950s, actually, there's a great letter where when he was a student in London, he had a Fulbright. And he's very concerned because he's been told that there have been intelligence reports that he might be cavorting with communists. And of course, if you were a student in London in the early 1950s, you would I mean, there was a pretty strong left wing and a labor movement which had communist elements in it. So he really felt that red baiting, he really hated red baiting throughout his career. And it made him very unsympathetic to the FBI. So he takes note of that with Bobby Kennedy, just in signaling to him in that letter that you mentioned, watch out for Hoover. Watch out for the FBI. It's a really great little moment there.
It actually makes the dark side of Washington kind of appear in little tiny pieces.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and also Moynihan's relationship with the Kennedys. As I say in my introduction, you know, there's a certain generation, and I would include myself in this, for whom, you know, John F. Kennedy really pulled the sword from the stone. That was what Camelot was all about. It's hard to imagine. I guess there was a little bit of that in 2008 with the early idealism about President Obama. But for Kennedy, it just hit the country and it hit the generation that Moynihan was in. And the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963 was so devastating to that generation and to Pat Moynihan, whose words on that occasion still echo and are still moving. And there are these letters and transcripts of his comments then. He was only an obscure assistant secretary of labor, but when in an interview he said, "I don't suppose there's any point in being Irish if you don't know the world is going to break your heart. I just thought we had more time." That couple of sentences really still sends chills through me because it's so moving. And Pat Moynihan's eloquence in public, but also in these letters, it really comes to life.
When you look at the book in whole now, from beginning to end, what do you think it tells us about the policymaking process and how it's changed?
I think it tells you how complicated and how much patience you need. But it also, I think Moynihan's signal contribution is something that was also an amazing discovery in these letters. In the 1980s, he gave some lectures at Harvard. And then in the last month of his life, when it seems to me he understood that the end was near because he was sick for quite some period in and out of hospitals, he writes, "In 40 years of government service, I've learned one thing, and that is that the conservative axiom of American politics is that culture, not politics, determines the success of a society, but that the liberal truth is that politics can save a culture from itself." And then he says something really important, which runs through his career and really is the answer to your question, which is that these two truths together strengthen our society. As he writes, I think, "They may have made us a stronger country than we would have otherwise been." And I think that after this toxic period that we've gone through, where it's been so divisive and we're so appalled at the fury of disagreement, I think the one contribution Pat Moynihan might have made to this debate is, hey, look, this is the way we debate things. We've been debating the role of government since Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. This is not bad for us to do. This is good for us to do. How else are we going to solve these our problems except by having these debates? But he would also say they should be based on facts.
Right. Well, great. I think that's a perfect place to end. Stephen Weissman, thank you so much for coming in. Again, the book is called Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait and Letters of an American Visionary. It's a collection of his letters.
Thank you so much for having me. It's fun to talk to you.
Thank you. When we come back, scandal and silence, why so many scandals go unnoticed, why some become national stories, and how this phenomena affects our society. Next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What makes some misdeeds rise to the level of scandal, while others fade out, hardly noticed? Why is it that the same type of transgressions are treated differently at different times? And might this differential treatment affect our politics, our policies, and society? With us are three experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and international affairs at the George Washington University and author of numerous books, including Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and his latest, Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Brendan Nyhan is also with us. He is professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media, and the Truth. Sigurd Ahlern also joins us from Stockholm. Stockholm. He is professor of journalism studies at the University of Oslo and Stockholm University and author of Scandalous, the Mediated Construction of Political Scandals in Four Nordic Countries. So you all study this scandal and mass media, this intersection between scandal, mass media, and public understanding of scandal. I thought we should start with a context about why it's important for the public to understand these scandalous issues and why it's important for scholarship to delineate what it all means for us. Bob Entman, why don't you lead us with why this is important?
Perhaps the primary duty of a media in a democracy is to alert the public to what their leaders are up to. And when leaders are misbehaving, if they're acting in an incompetent fashion, a corrupt fashion, it seems to me there's essentially nothing more important for the media to tell us about. And when those things happen, sometimes call them scandals. The other thing that media need to do is hold the officials accountable. So it's not merely a matter of alerting the public to the misconduct, but making sure that enough information is out that the public and other leaders will pursue the matter until the guilty party, if he or she is guilty, is held accountable.
So in essence, there's an accountability issue, but there's also a democratic issue attached. Would you say that's the case?
Absolutely. In countries where corruption is ignored or papered over, those places are less functioning democracies.
Brendan Nyhan.
Well, I agree with Bob. It's a hugely important issue. You just have to look at recent political history in this country. Three of the last eight presidents were forced out of office or had their tenure seriously threatened by scandal, Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton. And scandal has frequently dominated the national political discussion and debate in place of more substantive policy issues. So there's two sides to this coin. On the one hand, as citizens, we want our leaders to be held accountable when there is misconduct. But on the other hand, there may be cases where allegations of misconduct get wide publicity, even though they're not well substantiated. And we've seen examples of both of those. And the media seems to get it wrong, at least as often as they get it right. So it is very important to think about how this process works.
So then we have this aspect of false alarms and false accusations that we should get into. Sigurd Allern, is there anything you'd like to add to this context?
I agree that political scandals often function as a sort of political control. They inform us. They are necessary and healthy for democracy. And I basically accept that argument. But I think it also would be naive to interpret any mediated scandal as a strengthening of democratic processes. You have superficial scandals, you have more irrelevant scandals, so we have also to ask what type of scandals are important.
And that would get us right into the substance of the research that the three of you are doing. It seems that there are two general myths in the United States about mass media and scandal, and both seem wrong according to your research. The first deals with, say, the Watergate scandal as evidence of the media's vigilance. But then there's the second narrative that mass media focuses on only scandal that doesn't really have major public implications but are really private matters like sex scandals. Let's start with your core findings and what it says about these myths.
First of all, the idea that the media are hungering for scandal in any form is truly misleading. It implies that, first of all, that the media are in control of whether there's a scandal or not, and that really isn't the case. It ignores the fact that in many cases, perhaps most cases, knowledge that is fairly well rooted in confirmed fact is often ignored, even when it has to do with sex scandals, and most certainly when it has to do with much more serious substantive abuses of power, incompetence, and corruption. So I think it's awfully important that we understand that the media are not vigilantly on guard against either all trivial scandals or all important scandals. It's a much more complicated process determining whether we have a scandal or not that has relatively much less to do with what the person actually did and much more to do with things like which party is more skilled, which political party has the most incentive to promote a scandal. And when you have a situation, for example, where neither party in the United States or none of the parties in multi-party democracies are interested in promoting a scandal, you won't really get one, even if the media want one.
So then it brings up the role of the political elites, the elected officials, rather than the journalists as sitting in the driver's seat. Is that how your research has panned out?
Yes, I think for the most part, if the leaders, if at least some important leaders, aren't really interested in promoting a scandal over a matter, it won't happen, no matter how serious the underlying misconduct is.
Brendan Nyhan, is this also what your research has found?
I largely agree with Bob on this. I've described scandal as a co-production, typically in the case of U.S. presidents, between the media and the opposition party. It's certainly true that the media can't create scandal on its own in most cases, but there's often a synergistic relationship with the political party when people, at least some people, as Bob said, in that party, want to create a scandal. So a good example of when this doesn't happen is the period after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, when many, if not most, Democrats at the national level were wary of going after President Bush, who still had high approval ratings and a wartime president aura. And so allegations that might have turned into scandals in other contexts typically fizzled and died because the opposition party was wary. But it also was a case where the media, too, was wary of challenging a wartime president who had this aura around him.
And is that how it occurs in Europe as well, Sigurn Allern?
In the Nordic countries in Europe, we have another media system, another political system, and countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark just some decades ago were looked upon as more or less a scandal-free zone. But that has changed, and our research shows that in the last decade, there has been a large increase in media reports about different types of scandals. But when you look into it, only around 40% of national political scandals was directly concerned with politics. More than 60% were personal acts in a more or less private role or a personal act in a sort of political role. But it were very few, relatively few political scandals, which really was about politics and important political questions.
Let's use some specific examples that our audiences can relate this to. Bob Entman, you looked at several different kinds of scandals in your book and found that, for example, media are very inconsistent with even the sexual misconduct. They have gone after some, such as Bill Clinton, and they haven't gone after others, including John McCain and George H.W. Bush. Why the discrepancy?
The discrepancy has a lot to do with the particular alignment of forces at a particular time. In the case of Clinton, you had an opposition party, the Republicans, who were determined to undermine him and use every lever they could, and he gave them quite a wonderful opportunity with his actual behavior, which was confirmable by scientific analysis. In the case of the senior Bush, John McCain, Bob Dole, you had somewhat less direct or scientific evidence, although I dare say you had enough evidence to convict in most courts, and yet the media sat on this information, gossiped about it privately, but never blew it up into a scandal. I think in each of those cases, you may argue that it wasn't the media's fault. In fact, maybe the media did the right thing. The real problem is the inconsistency. What that means is that the media intervene in the outcome of elections. So that, for example, in 1996, they admitted after the election that they sat on information about Bob Dole's infidelity, which, in fact, was quite clearly known in Washington among the insiders. And they did so for this kind of murky reason about the long time ago, and we don't want to invade his privacy. Well, if that were a consistent standard, I think it would be good, actually. But it's not. That didn't hold for Bill Clinton. It may or may not hold in the future. It's the inconsistency that I think is particularly troublesome, and it also means that when, as in the case of Clinton, one of the parties is determined to get this information out, it may get out and distort the electorate's view of their politicians, because let me tell you that the rate of these kinds of things among politicians in Washington is very high.
This also occurred with very substantive issues beyond sexuality, which you noted. The New York Times sat on a George W. Bush, I think you called them potential scandals, dealing with spying on Americans. How do we explain this?
Well, in that case, I think you had the national security claim, which presidents, when they can use it, it's usually pretty effective. Indeed, I think it helped George W. Bush in quite a few contexts. But here's another example with George W. Bush. He engaged in insider stock trading while his father was president. It was investigated by the regulatory authorities, and they found insufficient evidence to pursue the matter. Now, if you compare that to what happened under Clinton, where there was, as we all know, many millions of dollars expended for years and years on an investigation of every possible detail, which ultimately led to Monica Lewinsky, you see the level of inconsistency that if a president's business dealings prior to being president are relevant to the public, then they should be consistently relevant. And in that case, in essence, the Bush family covered up what George W. Bush had done quite successfully. And you mentioned Watergate. Let me just say that the biggest problem with Watergate is that people assume that that is the typical political scandal instead of what it is, which is the unique political scandal that actually did lead to the fall of a president because of corruption.
Brendan Nyhan.
A couple of things. The discussion we're having, I hope, underlines for your audience the extent to which scandals aren't simply a function of whether there's evidence of misconduct or credible allegations, which has been a subtext of a lot of what we're talking about, but I think it's important because that's typically how people think about scandal. The other point that we haven't quite brought up is the way in which an allegation is consistent with a view of a politician, a stereotype, is often quite powerful. So Clinton had a persona as a womanizer or flirtatious or someone who had problems in his marriage. And so the allegations against him fit with that persona, which had been brought to the surface during his primary campaign with the Jennifer Flowers allegations. So the Monica Lewinsky allegations were already been legitimized, whereas Dole was injured in World War II quite substantially. John McCain was seen as a war hero, and it was less consistent with the public personas of those men.
There's one other piece, Brendan Nyhan, that I wanted to ask you about before we go back over to look at the European examples. One of the things you wrote about was how these scandals get buried with other pressing stories and how politicians use these more pressing issues to avoid the scandals becoming publicized.
I think this is an important piece of when scandals happen. We've talked about the strategy of a party going after someone on a scandal or not, but there are also things that are outside of your control. In the case of my research, I've looked at things like, does a hurricane hit? Is there a mass shooting? Is there an earthquake? Things that dominate the news out of nowhere. But you can think of lots of other examples. When there are big events in the news, it displaces other stories, and sometimes the media's attention is elsewhere. They're devoting their resources to covering other stories, and they're not as interested. In other cases, the media are bored. They're sitting around looking for something to write about. This is the classic story of the slow news period that is often told about the summer, but it can happen almost any time of year when the political media really has nothing to write about. And in those circumstances, an allegation which might get ignored in a different context can take off.
Sigurd Alern, let's take a look at how this is playing out in Europe. What are some specific examples?
There's a lot of differences in Europe. If you look at the UK, you have had scandals concerning what you call sex scandals. You have politicians with mistresses and so on. The same conduct in France is no scandal. It has been a change of climate because of the last affair. But in most European countries, you have all the norms, which can make the type of mediated scandals different. In Nordic countries, you normally do not write a lot about politicians' sexual affairs, and you did not write about politicians with problems with alcohol, but there has been a change in the last decade. Well-known example in the Nordic countries is Finland, where it was possible for a politician 2-3 decades ago to have grave alcohol problems without this being a scandal or looked upon as a scandal. But today the climate, the norms have changed. So the demands concerning a politician's conduct are other than before, and therefore such affairs can be scandalized in another way. So the norms are changing and influencing what's talked about and what's looked upon as scandals. In many cases, political scandals are not built upon great revelations, muckraking, a lot of investigating journalistic works. It's based on leaks. It's based on leaks from different political actors who use scandalizing in the political process. Most journalists, when we discuss scandals, are referring to, also referring in Europe and the Nordic countries, to Watergate. But I agree that the Watergate example is also for European journalism quite untypical.
Bob Entman.
I was just going to ask Professor Allen about the degree to which there is consistency now. Are they consistently going after every sex scandal, or is it more depending on different rivalries and different political interests?
I do not think they are consistently going after sexual scandals. There have been a few scandals, and in Norway, to an example, several of them have been about opposition right-wing party called the Progressive Party, which is, has been a sort of underdog in the political system. So I think there is clear differences between how politicians are treated, yes.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle. We are analyzing why some transgressions become scandals while others don't, and how it affects our society and politics. There are some things that all three of you are pointing to, and some of this has been in your work already, and that is that it seems like some of the determinants are, A, that the scandal is easy to go after and easy to confirm. It's either been laid out already by the opposition party, or there are hearings being held, as in the case of Watergate, which, Bob Entman, you have written about and talked about quite a bit. Very easy to point a finger to somebody, so there's a personalization element to it. But it seems there's also another piece that is not being talked about, which is political power. Bob, you wrote about this too, and I wanted to see if you might address it, where the more powerful people tend to be scrutinized perhaps the most carefully.
It's interesting because I think the stereotype of the media tends to be that the more powerful you are, the more vulnerable you are, and the more careful you have to be. But my research suggests that because of some of the things we've already talked about, you really can't make that claim. And in fact, you might argue that the more powerful you are, in many cases, the less likely you are to be held accountable. So, for example, if a president is very popular and to the point that the opposition party may be reluctant to attack very hard, that translates into a protection for the incumbent, even if certain allegations arise. And the second point about this that I think is very important for your audience and Americans to understand is that frequently the most serious corruption may involve institutions. For example, let's say the Federal Reserve Bank and the Securities and Exchange Commission, thinking about the horrible economic meltdown of the last few years and the numerous crimes that were committed by major banks and the lack of regulation and I think conflicts of interest between people who were in government but who wanted to have a career in banking and vice versa. All of that has yielded, as everyone in the audience knows, no scandal. There has been nobody who's gotten in trouble or been held accountable for this. And in that case, you have to say, of course, the cause of this misconduct is sort of the entrenched way the system operates. In that sense, it is the very most powerful institutions and the most deeply rooted causes of the problems that may yield corruption that are the least vulnerable to truly being revealed and held accountable.
I think that at least our research in the Northern Europe show that most scandals are about or limited to individual personal or moral transgressions, and very few of them involve institutional questions or structural questions or institutions. And you also have, I think, several examples in the Nordic countries showing that a relatively grave accusations and in some ways attempts or scandals concerning important members of government, like the Swedish foreign minister, Carl Bildt, with his relations to oil company, with interests in Africa. There has been a lot of debates. He's sort of untouchable in the Swedish government. He's too important. It's quite impossible that Carl Bildt should lose his position as long as this government is in power. But if you are a minor member of government, if you're not so important, if you are a minor politician, relatively speaking, well, then you much more easily will lose your position if it's a coalition government, if you fall on the smaller parties and so on. We have seen that in Sweden, we have seen that in Denmark, we have seen the same thing in Norway. And in general, we also found that around the double, if we compare men and women in government positions, and when women in government positions are being scandalized, around 60% of the female members of government scandalized had to go. They lost their position. Around 60% of the men kept their position. They were just criticized. So there is a difference. And if you're important, if you have a real strong position, the consequences will be another than if you are a minor member of government or not so important politician.
Bob Entman, that sounds very similar to some of the things that you found in terms of power, and that the people who are least powerful or a few steps down from the person of power tend to be the ones that take the fall. But there's one other piece that I wanted you to address, and that is you mentioned that cover-ups often work, and that's why they're practiced. And number two, there's been a practice of going after media themselves, such as in the case of Dan Rather and others. Can you talk about how that offense's defense is affecting media's ability to expose scandal?
I think it's important to realize, and this is very much contrary to the conventional wisdom, that cover-ups do work. We often hear that the best advice for a politician accused of wrongdoing is to get all the facts out right away and just lay them all out and apologize. Well, sometimes they do that and sometimes it works, but quite often they do engage in cover-ups and quite often they work. It's only if you assume that the media have this extraordinary degree of investigative power does it make sense not to try a cover-up if that looks like it might succeed. As an example, think about how when the issue arose of Mitt Romney's tax returns, there's a lot of writing about this in the media early on that said, well, he's going to have to release them anyway, so why doesn't he just get it all out now, early in the campaign? And I predicted, no, he would cover them up, and that was his best strategy. So we really need to understand the notion that cover-ups don't work is wrong. They often do work, and they are a good strategy, which means for the average citizen that you're not finding out about a lot of potential scandals.
Brendan Nyhan, would you agree?
Well, this gets into the difficulty of studying scandal, which is agreeing on what a scandal is or what a potential scandal is. It's often very difficult. It involves subjective judgments about what is or is not misconduct, what is or is not inappropriate, what actions are or are not justified. And those are very hard for us to agree on, even just as scholars. And then for the larger public, which is, of course, very polarized, especially the people who follow politics closely, it's very hard to agree on what is or should be a scandal. So it is difficult to say that something should have been a scandal and wasn't. I think we can agree, though, in some cases, that here's a candidate that looks like something that could have been a scandal if things had broken differently. Maybe we don't agree normatively on whether the action actually was misconduct or not, but we can say, I can imagine this being a scandal. And that may be unsatisfying, especially when it comes to people we don't like. We're often quick to rush to those normative judgments that they did something wrong. And that's part of what makes scandal so powerful, but it also makes it so hard to figure out what should be a scandal or not.
That brings up three things, really. One is your notion that the mass media professionals act like juries or act like chaplains or judges in their framing of the issue, having it either rise to the level of a scandal or not. But it also brings up two other really important points. One is the scandalization of things that may not have anything to do with a true scandal, such as if you watch some of the very conservative television and radio, and they have tried to scandalize climate science, calling it a fraud, And there is a healthy population who actually think that climate scientists are perpetuating a fraud.
That's actually an excellent example, the so-called Climategate, which was trumped up out of very flimsy evidence and yet was enormously successful as a political tactic, because you see that after that scandal arose, the amount of denial of climate change actually went up. Now, there may be other forces behind that change, but I think there's substantial evidence that that was a successful political strategy. And it again points to the fact that there is not a close connection between the underlying facts of the matter and whether or not, and the degree to which, something is framed as a scandal. In that case, you know, we have pretty strong scientific evidence that there is climate change, and the idea that thousands of scientists around the world are conspiring stretches the imagination, to say the least. Nonetheless, it was successfully used to the point that a good amount of the media coverage, not all of it, but a good amount of the media coverage, at least for some time after that, felt obligated to sort of treat the climate change deniers on an equal footing with the scientists who say it is happening.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about political scandals. Sigurd Allern.
Well, I think that in Northern Europe, at least, there is a relatively strong consensus concerning the dangers of climate change. But of course, you have others and some oppositional voices about this. But we have another problem, I think, because the basic idea in our part of the world, at least in the Nordic region, is that it's possible for rich countries to buy themselves out of it, to buy climate quotas and use the money to let poorer nations solve the problem, so to say, so we can go on like before. And I would say, coming from Norway, oil-rich and oil and gas production country, it's very difficult to mobilize real investigating journalism attacking some of the interests of the big oil companies and the state, who itself is one of the large oil exporters in the world. So in such affairs, journalism will meet very strong forces. It's difficult to make revelations that really counts. And I think that's a general problem here, that critical journalism needs a lot of knowledge, it needs a lot of resources. And if you don't have them, and if you're under a commercial enterprise, it's difficult to get such resources when the investigations and what you do is opposite of business interest.
There are three last things I'd like to address. One pertains to things that never really get to the level of scandal, like the issue of torture that we saw in the Bush administration, and specifically when the Obama administration released the document showing they'd tortured not to get confessions, but to falsely connect Saddam Hussein to 9/11, and why that never rose to the level of scandal. Bob Antman, why didn't this very serious issue rise to the level of a scandal?
I think at least two reasons. First of all, both parties are somewhat implicated in this problem. There's evidence that certain people in the Democratic Party were briefed, and so any thorough investigation could get both parties in trouble. Second of all, it was really Obama's call when he became president not to look backward, but only to look forward. And I think a part of that decision was based on the need to appear tough on terrorism. Nobody was going to outflank Obama on the right by saying he wasn't tough on terrorism. So among his decisions was, I'm not going to, you know, go over this torture business anymore. So there, it's just another one of many that we've talked about, examples of where a media report and even stuff that is confirmed factually doesn't necessarily in any way mean that there'll be a scandal of any significance.
Brandon, again, I'm going to point to you because you've looked at Obama and his particular avoidance of scandal for a very long period of time.
To a large extent, it's been the dog that hasn't barked of the Obama administration. There's been relatively little scandal under President Obama. There's a few different reasons that I've suggested why that might be. The first was the economy has struggled, so the Republicans have had a core issue. One of the reasons potentially that Republicans pursued Clinton so aggressively on scandal was, especially in his second term, was that the economy was doing quite well, and so they were looking for alternative grounds to criticize him. The other thing, we mentioned personality and consistency with narratives, and Obama's personal background as an adult that he wrote about in his book, he has very few allegations against him personally, and so things didn't line up with a stereotype or perception of his administration. And the final thing is just there were a huge number of big news events during the first couple years of Obama's administration, not just the economic collapse, but the oil spill in the Gulf, the Arab Spring. There have just been a series of large news events that have kept people busy and kept the media's focus elsewhere.
Now, there were a couple of attempted scandals. One was Fast and Furious and one was Solyndra, but they kind of fizzled out.
Yeah, they might have gotten just over the threshold if they were briefly considered as scandals in the national media, but they certainly never registered at the level of the big scandals that we think of over the past 20 or 30 years. They're kind of simmering below the surface.
Good old here. I want just to add that sometimes what happens in the U.S. and things the United States are responsible for in the world, well, maybe it's not treated as a political scandal in the U.S., but sometimes it's certainly treated like a political scandal in, like, the European and Nordic media. They are begrudged the questions about torture, the lies about weapons of mass destruction and so on. There has been really a lot of critiques. I have there is a large difference. It has, of course, with the political things to do. And I think if the election, the American presidential election, was in Europe, Obama would have got 85% of the vote.
Sigurd Allen, you had mentioned in your own work this very important role of the norms of a society, kind of the values that they hold dear, because scandal is, of course, a violation of those norms. And news media tend to focus on violations of norms. But then there's a role that news media play in setting up those norms and values as well. So how do you see this playing out in a comparison of Europe versus the United States?
The social media is important, but I think that concerning politics, at least as we have experienced it, social media mostly have a political role when the traditional media, newspapers, televisions, channels, and so on, pick up what's going on there. Very few of the debates and what's happening in the social media have a sort of direct impact on the large public sphere. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, let's toss it back over to Bob Entman then to take a look at this in the context of the social media.
One interesting point that Professor Allen raises is that there may be the paradox that there's more scandal reporting in Europe about what's going on in America than there is in America. So the citizens of Europe may have better information about some of the corruption that goes on in the United States or the misconduct than Americans themselves. And surely that is not the ideal situation. Normally we would want, you know, the country's own media to do a pretty good job. On the other hand, we've talked about all the ways in which it's difficult for the media to do that. I tend to think that social media can help to surface an issue. They can possibly give it a little more energy to be on the radar screens of politicians and journalists. But ultimately, the main gatekeepers remain really a handful of elite media in Washington and New York. And if they don't decide that they are going to go into this and cover it repeatedly and prominently, it doesn't really matter very much what's in the social media. I gave an example in the book, the John Edwards sexual escapades, which had all of these incredibly salacious and newspaper-selling kinds of details, including a love child. This was ignored by the mainstream media for months and months, even though it had scandal written all over it. That would be an example of something that if you were looking at the right blogs and at the right Twitter feeds and so on, you could actually find out about it. But politically, it was the tree falling in the forest and no one was there.
There are two big questions lingering. One kind of ties back to how we opened this discussion, which is what is the effect on the public? And I wonder if when mass media do not adequately cover these scandals, if we are then building kind of a culture of corruption.
I certainly wouldn't go that far. I think people in Washington are very concerned about being exposed. You may not turn into a scandal, but there are lots of people who've had their reputations ruined and ended up in jail or spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, even when they didn't really do anything. So are there ways our system could be improved? Of course. Is our political system perfect? No. But this is a difficult case because, again, it's very hard to agree on what the corruption is that we should be covering and how we should be holding officials accountable. And those are very hard lines to draw. I think the media could do a better job, but I wouldn't go so far as to say they're creating a culture of corruption.
Sigurd Allen?
I wouldn't use those words, but still I think that Professor Rentman in his book about scandal and silence has some important points concerning the lack of real critical journalism and watchdogs concerning the financial elites, the leading banks, what they do. And when you discover that they have a very negative role concerning the societal economy, they are bailed out. It's a lack of proportion between all the time we use to discuss minor scandals, minor revelation about individual problems and so on, and the lack of concentration of journalistic research and criticism on the important things concerning both the American and other society. I think that's an important point.
Bob Bittman.
This problem of failing to track the seriousness of the misconduct. It sounds like this is a problem not only in the United States but in Europe. And the one thing I guess I would ask members of the audience, citizens, to be aware that they really need to think for themselves and not judge whether an individual politician is corrupt or a certain series of actions are scandalous. They have to judge that for themselves rather than waiting for the media to package it as a scandal, because that might not happen. And I'd also ask journalists to be much more self-aware of this problem of calibrating the degree to which they frame something as a scandal and the underlying facts and the seriousness of the impact on the American people. We, I think, would have an improved democracy and a reduction of corruption if that calibration could be brought more into line.
Well, thank you all so much. Bob Entman, Brendan Nyhan, and Sigurd Allern, thank you all so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and international affairs at the George Washington University and author of numerous books, including his latest, Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Brendan Nyhan is a professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media and the Truth. Sigurd Allern is professor of journalism studies at the University of Oslo and Stockholm University and author of Scandalous, The Mediated Construction of Political Scandals in Four Nordic Countries. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Huatema Galeman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week. Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies.